welcome back. Nice to see all the faces and hope you're all well. So tonight we open the month of looking at emotions as Dharma practice. How that looks, how we work with that, how do we practice with that? I know some of us, we may have come to meditation for that very reason, is to find a way to work with those emotions which seem so overwhelming and so difficult. While others of us may have decided to come to meditation to get away from our emotions, to avoid them, to overcome them, to somehow not be so caught by them. Now, emotions are really a vital part of being human. It's kind of one of the defining features of being a human being. And learning to work with them in meditation and in the Dharma itself is a very profound gift you give yourself. And if you're not bringing it into your practice, we're missing something very important way to integrate daily life into our practice. So there's a couple ways I'm going to talk about exploring and working with emotions. One for this night and the next one in 2 weeks. The first way is more when those emotions are really gripping. It's like almost a storm going through our system, that the emotion is very charged. It has a lot of strong self-belief. It's very personal. Yeah, so we're almost looking at the kind of the first aid to how do you work that? How do you find a sense of ground in the midst of those emotional storms when we're overwhelmed and it feels like it's too much to hold? The other way is when emotions are a little bit more quiet, more nuanced, and how emotions can be a gateway into investigation, a gateway into investigating an aspect of the Dharma and how suffering arises and how suffering ceases. So it's also very helpful because emotions often do catch our attention. We feel that sense of unease, even if it's very subtle. And that can be a gateway to understanding deeper levels of identification, deeper levels of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. And we'll focus more on that in 2 weeks for the second talk in this little series here. But both of these approaches do blend together. They start to become really one and the same. So it just depends on how intense the emotions are. So in talking about emotions, particularly tonight, we'll kind of focus on the four core emotions of sadness, of happiness, of anger, and fear. So, of course, there's many nuances. There's combinations of these. There's things like longing. There's things like disgust. There's all these different qualities of pride, for example. But I think when we are really charged and triggered by emotions, they usually fall into one of these four areas. Even happiness can have a quality of intensity to it, a charge to it itself. And you may notice that emotions often have a drive towards some action. They're driving us to do something with or from that emotion. It may be something external, like some kind of communication, writing an email, a text, right? Verbal communication. It could be an action of the body. Or maybe internal, the way that we're kind of collapsing around, or our self-talk, the storm of thoughts that just keep going from one thought to the other. And so as meditators, we learn to pause, to work with these emotions by almost suspending that impulse to act long enough to actually investigate, to actually see the nature of this emotion, start to see the suffering and also the release of that suffering. And ultimately learning how to embrace the full emotional life as us as human beings. And that way, the pause, that simple slowing it down, allows us to act in a much more skillful way toward ourselves and toward others. Because I think we all don't have to reflect very long to recall a time when we were hurt by someone's using their emotions in a way that was harmful, or how ourselves have harmed others through our emotions, how we acted out, sent that email without really pausing, and cause that ripples of harm and hurt. how he calls it, internal suffering that we feel as we get gripped by those emotions. So turning toward emotion as a practice is in some ways really turning toward our suffering. And this is something that we don't have to practice very long to realize that there is a level of suffering that just often under the surface, or perhaps so obvious that we can't avoid it. And learning how to turn toward it, how to meet it with this quality of wisdom and compassion, is really what the practice needs to bring to our lives. Ajahn Chah, the famous Thai forest master, talked about two kinds of suffering. He said there's two kinds of suffering, the suffering which leads to more suffering, and the suffering which leads to the end of suffering. The first is the pain of grasping after fleeting pleasures and aversion for the unpleasant, the continued struggle of most people day after day. The second is the suffering, which comes when you allow yourself to fully feel the constant change of experience, pleasure, pain, joy, and anger, without fear or withdrawal. The suffering of our experience leads to inner fearlessness and peace. So he's pointing toward these two ways we can relate to the suffering, to our emotions. We can relate to it in a way that perpetuates the suffering, that re-engages it, that reinforces it, or in a way that eases it, or even leads to the end of suffering, the ultimate sense of freedom, the sense of release. So Dharma practice is really concerned about that release in an ultimate way. So we often need to work with emotions enough to find that sense of ease, a sense of stability. And much of it is learning to embrace the fullness of us as human beings, the full catastrophe, as John Kibbutz Zen coined the phrase. But ultimately, we're looking at how does suffering, or how does it working with emotions lead to that liberation, to lead that sense of liberation of our hearts. So as I mentioned tonight, we'll focus more on those intense emotional storms, the ones that really hold us in our grip. You know, perhaps that happened today. Perhaps you're dealing with something in your life that is very disturbing. There's a lot of unknowns, like a diagnosis, a loss of a loved one, the uncertainty of some aspect of your life. Perhaps it's the harm that has been caused by someone's interactions with you. Perhaps there's so many myriad ways we can have that grippingness. But they all have this quality of thought that just kind of self-perpetuates, the proliferation of thought, the papancha. And so I thought I would share three general approaches that I have found very helpful in my own practice and also in the practices of students that have been able to help and guide around this. I'm going to present them in kind of a loose sequence or order, a way that often may be helpful to go through, but to realize that they really support each other. They really build upon each other. So you may find yourself working with one and then go into the next one and then go back to the first one. And they just start to support each other and build in a kind of synergy over time as we practice. So the first one is to find a sense of stability, a sense of ground, and also a sense of space, a sense of spaciousness, to start to take the pressure off. Because when we're in the midst of a very strong emotion, it sweeps us off our feet. We don't have any capacity to find the ground, to find the present moment. It feels so personal, so deep. And this talk is no means to discount the very real struggles that many of us are having right now or will have or have had. But learning how to navigate that, how to navigate it with the Dharma, with our minds. We still have those difficult situations and experiences to work with and to find a way through. This is really speaking toward how does our mind relate to it? How do we find a sense of peace through our relationship to it? How to work with it, as Ajahn Chah said, the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. So first, finding a sense of some kind of spaciousness, some way to take that pressure off in some way. Because when we reflect on when we're caught in an emotion, you know, we're really angry about something, we're very fearful, very sad, it's like our whole world kind of closes down. It's like there's nothing but that one experience, that one thing that we're just churning over again and again. And then this seems to be so personal. It means so much about me and my future, my past, about the other person. It just there seems like there's no space available. So how do we find that quality of space so we're not continued swept away? And these are things that we may find that spaciousness and that ground for a few seconds and they be swept away and then we come back, find a few more seconds of it. So it's kind of a process. It's not like a magic turn the switch and suddenly everything's happy and good. Just to keep the sense of these are charged, these are difficult. So even with a difficult situation experience, that sense of pausing, of slowing down the reactivity. It's helpful to reflect that emotions are not an emergency. That emotions are not an emergency. They may feel that way in the present moment, that this is such an emergency. Something has to be done right here, right now. But often that leads to us acting from a reactive standpoint, a reactive stance that creates more and more turbulence in the world and in our lives. We also take emotions very personally. You know, I'm the one who's angry. I'm the one who's hurt. I'm the one who's terrified. I'm the one who is gripped by grief and sadness. They seem to really define us. And learning to start to see them less personally, to start to see them as part of this human condition. So reflecting that we are not our emotions, even though it feels that way. Even though we talk about it, I am mad, I am sad, I am scared, I am happy, I am this way. Learning to have that spaciousness as part of the process is loosening that identification, that belief making around it, releasing that strong sense of self, which is generated by that emotion. So this quality of finding ground, finding a sense of stability, finding a sense of spaciousness, it's helpful to find some connection with the present moment. I like to feel my feet, you know, when I'm really gripped by something. I remember just sometimes being just floored and completely overwhelmed by painful interactions or painful experiences. And the mind, you see, is not a refuge in those times. The mind takes us into the future, into the past, and just relives it again and again. And so to find some gateway, some place to connect with this present moment, you know, feeling the feet, maybe stepping a little more strongly, just taking a few deep breaths, really emphasizing the exhale, that sense of easing, sense of releasing. Connecting with something in the environment which is pleasant, which is actually not of that pain that you're struggling with. This is one of the techniques I learned in working with trauma, is to learn to look at, in the present moment, the trauma may be just generating through your system, but to find something in your experience. It may be the sight of the beautiful tree with the light upon it. It may be, could be the breath. It could be the sensation of your hand, the warmth in your hand. Something that's not of that trauma, not of that pain, not of that emotion, and really directing your attention to that. What that does is it learns to, it teaches you find that connection to the present moment, to ground to the present moment. Expanding the sense of container, you know, what's holding this experience. So often when it feels overwhelming, it's because it's too much for us to hold. These are often the words we use when we talk about these times, that this is just too much to bear, too much to hold. I can't, it's overwhelming. And it is. And if we step back and able to look at how our mind and how the sense of me is relating to it, it's so, the whole sense of me is tied up into that. And it's too big of an experience to hold. And so what I found is very helpful is to try to expand the container, the sense of what is actually holding that experience. And so sometimes I remember dealing with the painful disillusion of a relationship, of a committed relationship, and just feeling, you know, this really deep grief, this deep pain, this deep anger. And a friend, a teacher, said, okay, look, gaze upon, you know, the expanse, the far horizon in the landscape, and imagine that that pain, that sorrow, it just being spread out. And so it's being, the spaciousness is being held, the pain is being held by the spaciousness of the environment, of the landscape. For me, that is a very helpful process. Even walking in the forest and just feeling the trees and the sky, the earth itself holding this experience. The Buddha would speak of this, there's a sutta called the simile of the saw, where he suggests being like the earth, being like the sky, being like the air, that even though there may be something very painful coming toward you, how this air itself is undisturbed by it, how the earth can hold it without any reservation, without any effort, and how the sky can just simply hold it without any sense of reservation. To teach ourselves, to kind of use nature to teach us that. Because no matter how much pain we might be feeling, nature doesn't seem to flinch. Nature doesn't seem to react. It doesn't try to fix you or solve you. And if you let it, it simply embraces who you are right there in that moment. And, you know, if you tend to be, like myself, a little bit more private around emotions, having that sense of not having to worry about someone taking care of me or trying to fix me, and just to let their emotions be fully felt. It's so helpful. And all this is about expanding the container. The Buddha would use this analogy of a cup of salt put into like a quart of water, and how that salt would just make that water completely undrinkable. We take that same cup of salt and we put it in, let's say, 5 or 10 or 20 or 100 gallons of water, the salt disperses. So this is what he's talking about, is making things more spacious, to go from that sense of contained, contracted container that I am holding this, I am struggling with this, to having the sense of something much larger holding this experience. Another way to help expand and find that ground is by sharing with a loved one, or trusted, someone who you trust to hold you and to relate to you in a skillful way. Just talking with a friend, with a loved one. Sometimes that helps you expand that container, that you know you're not the only one who's feeling this and bearing this. This is why support groups and therapy is so powerful, because you start to see someone else reflecting your own experience, normalizing it. So you're going from that personal contraction to feeling the universality of that experience. And finally, one other way I'll suggest around expanding the container is through ritual, some type of ritual. It may be something that is very, you know, prescribed or created, or it might be something we just make up on the spot. I remember Philip Moffat giving me an assignment of taking a rock when I was dealing with something difficult, and imagining infusing, you know, all of this suffering into that rock, and then placing that rock someplace in nature. So the rock is holding it, and nature is holding it as well as me. So something as simple as that. Sometimes on retreats, I ask people who are struggling to write out a few words about their struggle and then give it to me. And I don't read it unless they ask me to, and I maybe put it by the Buddha statue or have them do that. So they have a sense of the whole Sangha, the whole lineage. The Buddha himself is helping hold that experience. This is all about moving from that contraction of overwhelm into a sense of spaciousness. Something bigger holding this experience. So this is the first way of working with it, finding that place of ground. And often we need to work with this in some way to be able to move to this next phase. Otherwise, it just sweeps us off our feet. And again, it's something we may have to keep applying again and again. Being patient with yourself. Being patient, especially some of these very difficult, gripping experiences. Okay, the second way, in some ways, is the most difficult. And this is, and also the most important. And this is releasing our story, our beliefs around the emotion. Okay, so releasing the story and the beliefs about what it means about me, about someone else, around this emotion. Because if we don't do that, the beliefs, the story, the thought process keeps the emotion really enmeshed and gripped and caught. As we see it as one mass, one thing, it's very difficult to work with. Because emotions and thoughts just start to feed off each other. I start to think about this painful experience, and I start to have emotions around it, feel that in my body. That regenerates more emotions, more thoughts. It starts to get bigger and bigger. It starts to spiral in a bigger, bigger mass. One of the first teachings I heard about emotions when I started to practice, you know, many years ago, was by a teacher named Shinzen Young. And he talked about emotions in this way. He said, imagine that you're looking at a mass of pink yarn from the distance. Okay, so from the pink yarn represents emotion that's happening in our bodies, in our minds. As we get closer to it, we start to see that pink mass, what looked pink from afar, is actually a tangled up mess of thought and emotion, a physical sensation. And he said, okay, the white threads are the thought, the emotion, or the thoughts, the beliefs, the story, while the red threads are the sensations in the body. And they get tangled up, and from the distance, it looks like one big mass of pinkness. We start to tease those apart, we see they're actually two different threads. And this is really the core basic technique in dealing with emotions, is to start to tease those apart. To see that, oh, there's the thoughts about the emotion, the belief around the emotion, and this is the physical sensation of that emotion. And learning to reorient and ground ourselves in the physical sensation is really the heart of the practice. Because if we can ground in the physical sensation, guess what? We're grounding in the present moment. If we become lost in the thoughts and story, we're moving away from that present moment. The present moment is the only place we have any point of power, any point of influence, any point of application of our skills. Because we can go into the future and what ifs and what could have happened. And it's all amorphous. So learning to come into the present moment is such a key part of working with emotions. So when emotion arises, it's really helpful to start to tease apart those two aspects. Noticing, okay, what's the emotion and what's the belief around that emotion is another way of looking at it. Because emotions do carry this, especially the ones that are gripping, they carry this belief, what it means about me, what it means about my future, my past, what it means about my relationships, you know, my health, my financial security, whatever it is that is gripping us. There's this belief that's also there. And realizing that is just a belief, that it's just a thought versus the reality. And at the same time, noticing where is this felt in the body? What is right here, right now? So to do this, we do have such a strong, almost addiction or gripping around the beliefs and thoughts. They just grip us and they hold us very tightly. So learning to suspend that and learning to connect with the physical sensations. And that way we start to learn another way of being spacious around emotion. And that spaciousness paradoxically allows us to actually examine and investigate those beliefs. This is more about what we'll talk about in a couple weeks. Because that belief system is part of what shores up and creates that sense of self. It's part of what perpetuates that sense of delusion. There's a self, sense of I, sense of me, sense of mine. Now, another way that we can work with this, the same general area of learning to tease apart, to release our beliefs and our story, is to investigate our very kind of, our, how to say it, the belief we have around the emotion itself. Because each one of us has a emotional bias. We have emotions which are acceptable and emotions which aren't acceptable in our own minds, our own hearts. So part of it, we have to really learn to acknowledge and discover what that emotional bias is. And this is what we've been taught from our families of origin, how we're taught by our friends, taught by the culture itself. You know, this is an emotion that's okay to feel if you are, let's say, a boy. I remember seeing a painful interaction when at my daughter's elementary school at that point. So when a young boy fell and scraped his knee, and the father came over and said, kid's crying, and said, don't cry, don't cry. You know, he didn't say this part, but it's because you're a boy, boys don't cry. So this is, you know, a stereotypical thing, but it's also a very real thing. It's so much as people who identify more in a masculine or male way, we hold that quality of emotions, of sadness, of vulnerability, tamped down. But it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be these other emotions. Same thing with maybe the female gender. That sometimes there's a quality of being, it's okay to be sad or be okay to be frightened, but not to be angry. These are, of course, generalizations, and they do, anytime the generalization won't fit all things. And the key thing is to find for ourselves, where is that? And where is that thing that we always feel? What's our default emotion? Maybe I'm much more comfortable being afraid and scared and sad than being angry, for example. So recognizing that as a Dharma practice, the beautiful thing about it is it's not about changing it or fixing it, but just noticing it, shining the light of our awareness upon that experience, that biasing of our minds. Because that bias then, of course, creates a certain stance in how we relate to emotions. Really a stance of how we relate to ourselves. Understanding how we relate to ourselves, that's part of the exploration of understanding the sense of self, the root of what causes suffering. Another form of this bias is noticing any tendency to kind of fake it, to have a sense of I am beyond feeling angry, I'm beyond feeling lustful, or afraid. The quality of okay, I'm a meditator. I'm a meditative teacher. Of course I shouldn't be angry. If I hold that as a belief, that creates a whole shadow. It creates a whole quality of holding off what's actually true in the moment. That's our only saving grace, is to have a deep, passionate desire to understand what is true in this moment. No matter what it might be, how shameful it might be, how embarrassing it might be, what is actually true right here? Because that truth allows us to start to use dukkha, suffering itself, as a gateway toward liberation. As long as we say, okay, I'm not going to feel that because I'm not supposed to, it doesn't fit with my self-image, we've tied ourselves up in a knot. We've really restricted the capacity of our hearts to fully awaken. It's only through this full embrace of our whole humanity. And yet we often do try to fake it. We do say, okay, I'm not supposed to feel that as a meditator. It doesn't fit with my self-image. You know, back to that simile of the saw, that sutta. The Buddha is trying to tell his monks and nuns, you know, about this, the sense of really owning your experience, owning your what's really present. And trying to move toward that sense of spaciousness, that sense of emptiness itself, which holds all emotion, which is actually the seat of metta. And he's telling the story about this woman and her servant, and how the woman was, you know, speaking in a very kind, nice way, and the servant was wondering if that was really as genuine as the person, the woman was presenting it. And so she decided to start to deliberately make some mistakes, like break a bowl here or shatter this and that, and would watch to see if the mistress would be, you know, very kind still. And sure enough, she would become more and more agitated, more and more upset at each of these escalation of making mistakes as the servant, to the point where she, you know, got very violent and angry. And so, you know, the Buddha was pointing toward the story to see, noticing how we're tested by life. You know, we often see this in relationships. Those of us who have children, you know, or maybe involved with teaching or something like that. You know, kids can often sniff off when you're not genuine. They can know where to push that button to see who you are, to see what's really there. So having that sense of deep trust, okay, this is what's here. An emotion's not a statement of who I am. It's just what's arising in this moment's experience. So learning how to see that emotion and see it as a felt sense in the body, and learning to hold the thoughts and beliefs in a lighter way, just actually release those, to actually become deeper, a deeper relationship to that emotion itself. So this is the second approach. You know, learning, this is really about learning to free the present moment from our history, from our past, so you can be fully present. The third way, the final way, is around finding the core of that emotion. Okay, again, we're talking about this emotional storm, this intense gripping quality. And so there's a superficial presentation of it, you know, being very angry about something, very fearful about something. This is often going to be our default emotion, the one that we're most conditioned to find comfortable, that we tend to go to our normal way of presenting our emotional lives. So that's like, that's the superficial way of experiencing it. Now this has tremendous amount of pain and a tremendous amount of belief, and there's story and belief that just kind of churning back and forth around that level. I remember feeling this, being upset at a boss, this was many years ago, and just going for this hike in this beautiful alpine meadow, but I wasn't really hiking. I was churning about, okay, I'm going to say that to her, and she said this, and just going back and forth. And at some point, I finally paused enough to stop resisting the emotion, to actually feel what is present, and to feel the anger separate from the beliefs around it. And then underneath, I could feel the sadness. I could feel the sadness which was hidden, but yet driving this whole process. And once I touched that sadness, then all that thought stream, that proliferation of thought that I had struggled with for hours and hours, softened and fell away. When I was fighting forest fire in another lifetime, you come upon a big smoking mass of fire and flame and ash coming up. And you could just throw your dirt or your water on the smoke. But what we were trying to do is find, where's the hottest part in that fire? Where's the part where it's burning the brightest, the red hot, the white hot, the core of that? That is where you direct your water. That's where you direct your dirt to try to smother it. That's where you try to break it apart. Trying to mess with the peripheral, it keeps the core intact. It keeps burning. And so this is what I mean by finding that core, is to turn toward that deeper pain, that deeper hurt. Now this may sound like kind of an intense thing to do, and it has an intensity to it. But once we do this a few times and we feel that touching the deeper core, and how all the superficial pain, again, not superficial as in not intense pain, but just the proliferation of pain, that superficial pain, when we touch the deeper part, that falls away. When we touch into the stillness, the sense of peace, we realize that this is the way that leads to the end of suffering. This is the way that leads, that suffering that leads to the end of suffering, that Ajahn Chah spoke of. So often we need to find that ground, find that sense of spaciousness. We need to learn to release the story in order to turn toward this deeper core peace here. The emotion underneath the emotion, the unseen current, which is driving it. Letting that be known. And then once we turn toward it and touch that most tender aspect, then we tend it. We tend toward it with compassion. We ask, what does it need? We ask that place from a quality of stillness, a quality of spaciousness. Right? So to do that, we have to have already found that spaciousness. We have to have already released the story enough to ask it from a quality of stillness. If we don't have that, we're going to ask it from a quality of reactivity, trying to get through this, to get over it, be free of it, which is that tension shows up in a way that we can't avoid. It, you know, creates a quality of tension and friction with that. But when we're able to really touch that tenderness, that most tender aspect of the quality of stillness and compassion, then we ask it what it needs. What does it truly need? What would be beneficial? Maybe something very concrete. Like saying, okay, I'm going to say no to this. I'm going to draw a boundary. I'm going to tell that person that I need to take a break from that interaction. Maybe it's releasing something, like the belief that you don't need help, that we have to do it ourselves. Maybe it's releasing the self-contracted belief of self-hatred. It's a live question that shows its, you know, shows in that moment. And if you get the right one, you can feel that softening. You can feel that shift. So you can see that this is a very dynamic way of working with emotions. That if you keep them in a quality of just on the superficial level, they tend to run us. They tend to drive us. They grip us. They perpetuate. And it goes on. Often for hours or days or years even, if we keep working with, you know, not working with it in this way. But if we learn to turn toward it and find that sense of spaciousness, that sense of ground, we start to bring it into our practice. We start to learn to release the story, the beliefs around it. Then we can start to connect with the actual felt sense, the sensations in the body, and start to see the emotions which are underneath the emotions. And then learning to touch and connect with the most tender aspect. And meeting that with a compassionate heart, the quality of softness, of sweetness, a sense of gentleness. And asking, what does it need? What is actually here? And this way, how we relate to that emotion, that allows us to start to lead toward the end of suffering. To again go back to Ajahn Chah to conclude. The two kinds of suffering by Ajahn Chah. The suffering which leads to more suffering and the suffering which leads to the end of suffering. The first is the pain of grasping after fleeting pleasures and aversion for the unpleasant. The continued struggle of most people day after day. The second is the suffering which comes when you allow yourself to feel fully the constant change of experience. Pleasure, pain, joy, and anger, without fear or withdrawal. The suffering of our experience leads to inner fearlessness and peace. The suffering which leads to the end of suffering. All right, thank you for your kind attention. If you could just sit quietly for a few moments, those words settle. In a few moments, we'll have a chance for some questions or comments. I just want to talk about the practice and reflection for this week. So again, this is the first entry into this topic of emotions in Dharma practice. this. And tonight we talk about the kind of the emotional storms and which just really grip us. But you can see as we talked about it, that it also starts to lead into this release of that, the release really into the nature of dukkha, the nature of suffering. And so the second talk in a couple of weeks, we start to learn to look at it from that investigative standpoint. For this week, so I put the piece of the homework into the chat for your practice and enjoyment. So this week, when you recognize an emotion is present, recognize it as a chance to practice the Dharma. Okay, this is the first piece there. That usually emotions, we just say, we just kind of wait till they pass, or we are reacting from them. But start to train yourself that when you feel an emotion, realize, oh, this is a chance to practice. And it's precious in that way. It's a precious opportunity to practice the Dharma. Because it's really a custom-built spiritual practice designed by your own conditioning. And so bring this emphasis not only when you're practicing formally in a seated practice or walking practice, but also into daily life. You may actually find this more accessible when you go through those rubs that life is constantly giving us. And use these three approaches that we talked about as a guide. Ground and create a sense of space. Release the story and the beliefs with it. And then find the most tender aspect of that emotion and tend it with compassion. Ask, what does it need? What does it need that's actually beneficial? So next week we'll have a kind of a reframing or recap of this talk and a chance for us to explore in some small groups this nature of emotions and how to work with it. And if bringing your sincerity to that discussion, I think will make it very fruitful for yourself and for everyone who listens. All right, so I'm going to give you permission to unmute yourself. We can have some dialogue. So you could either just go ahead and unmute yourself, or if you like to raise your hand, your virtual hand. I may not see your physical hand because I can only see a few of you at once. And to do the virtual hand, you can go down to the bottom and, or go to your name and raise your hand, I think. Or anyone have anything they'd like to share or dialogue about? All right, Katie, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, by the way, Tim. This is really, really helpful. I'm trying to think how to phrase this, but one thing that kind of stuck out to me was just thinking about releasing the stories and the beliefs, and that's something that I've been practicing. However, I've found that it can be a little unsettling too. Hmm. Like I've had these, I'm trying to think of an example, but like interactions with my family members, and I realize we have this kind of emotional connection. My parents are divorced and my mom has all these emotions and stories still about my dad. And then I'm realizing like, that's just her belief. But I'm finding like this, I mean, it's kind of negative, but I'm also finding some like attachment to it because that's like the story that I've always, like since I was 6 years old, kind of told and understood. And, sometimes it just feels like when I'm letting go of all of that, that some kind of the ground is just kind of falling off like from beneath me, if that makes sense. It's kind of hard to articulate. But I'm just wondering how to work with that. Like as these things, these emotions and stories kind of start to fall away more and like this like sense of self, how to stay kind of grounded in that. Cause sometimes it can just really, eat me away. I hope that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, you articulated that very well. And I think it's probably a disclaimer we should put on all these talks is that is if you practice what we're teaching, it does lead to that sense of the story falling away. And that's not just like a story that's fallen away. It's like the sense of you starts to fall away in relationship to that, especially something like that that's been so rehearsed from as a young child. And it's like, this is a foundation of what you believe about yourself, about your parents. And you start to see that just as a belief, it's like the ground does start to fall away. There is that sense of groundlessness that happens. So first of all, to reflect that, that's actually a sign that the Dharma practice is actually going deeply. That's the direction that the practice is designed to go. It's designed to point to that sense of groundlessness. And it is a little freaky. It's a little bit disconcerting because it's like, okay, who am I without that story? You know, what am I without that story? And it's something that we don't have an answer to that, because usually that answer is something that's really based on the stories. That's what defines us. Okay, so just to first hold, okay, this is what the practice is designed to do. This is what the Buddha discovered these 2,600 years ago. He didn't use these words. I'm really making it, you know, contemporary and modern. But really, if you look at the suttas, he's talking about that. In those phrases come through again and again, a sense of releasing the story, releasing the world, because that's the path to the cessation of suffering. So, but to get down to your question, how do you handle that sense of groundlessness, that sense of disillusion? So this kind of, there's also one way to work with it, a way that I found very helpful, is to see in that moment, there's actually two things that are going on. There's the fear of not being formed, the fear of not being defined. You know, the unknown is like, it's really epitomized by the unknownness, the unknown quality. The other side of it is the sense of wonder, the sense of limitless potential, and you know, the sense of that sense of deep interconnection, the sense of release of anything that needs to be done or changed in this moment. So they're both kind of there. Sometimes one leads versus the other one. And so often we have to kind of go through that initial fear, that initial terror, sometimes it is, to start to see, okay, what is on the other side of the story? And we start to see that is actually what our heart's been yearning. That's what brought us to practice in the first place. Is something that's so vast and so expansive, so without distinction, that it's something we can only kind of point toward with words, but we can't fully capture. That's what our heart has really yearned for. And then we start to realize, you know, part of the struggle is that it seemed like it's an either or, and it often is an either or at one point. But at some point, when we fully relax into that stillness, we see that the self still can pick up what it needs to. We can still talk to our mother about the story that she holds and meet her in a compassionate way, but still having this much bigger perspective that this is just form that's showing up and form that will fall away. And then we start to see that the passing and rising and passing of form, but we don't hold it in a sense, I have to have form be here. I don't have to have form not be here. I relax into something that's much more still, much more profound. It's hard to talk about this, but hopefully that kind of made some sense.
Yeah, no, that's helpful, and it does make sense. It's been interesting, too, because as I'm not getting tangled in those stories, when I'm interacting with my mom or my dad, I'm not really perpetuating that, and then it just kind of, like, dies off.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, I'm not getting... There's like, they want to like feed off of some energy or something like that. So it's just I'm trying to figure out how to like relate to people when that's happening as well. But that is helpful. So thank you. It's hard to talk about for sure.
Yeah. And that's just another thing that comes up as you said that is when you're like, that's a great articulation of you noticing that one of your parents brings up this story and wants you to interact with it. You can see that how much suffering is really tied to that story. and the perpetuation of that story. I mean, how many years has it been since they've been divorced? You know, it probably will serve them to let go of it, but they're not, you know, that they're not able to. And part of it is that perpetuation of the story. And, you know, it's actually a profound teaching for them. It's kind of a stealth teaching when you just don't engage in it. And then instead what you're engaging with them is who they are right here, right now.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. All right. So I see a question came in the chat from Kelly. Sorry, I got to remember to bring my glasses for this small screen here. So any advice for distinguishing between stepping back and connecting to the present moment versus escape from or avoiding difficult emotions? So I'm in a period of intense grief and finding it challenging in daily life to stay connected to the present while still allowing the intense emotions and thoughts to come up to exist and be tended to. I think sometimes I latch onto aspects of my experience that aren't related to the grief in a way that is helpful. So let me talk about the first part of your question. So the sense of escape, the sense of trying to not feel, I think we also have to give ourselves space to take a break, kind of the wise distraction. Because some of this stuff that comes up in our lives is so painful that if we just try to meet it all the time, we become exhausted. We become overwhelmed. And so sometimes finding that, okay, I'm distracting myself. I'm just watching a mindless movie or reading a novel or just doing something that takes my mind away. That's actually coming from a place of wisdom. You know? And so knowing that too, that sometimes that distraction is actually helpful. Sometimes we can use our practice in a way that isn't helpful. Like, okay, I'm going to just, I remember talking to a long-term student who whenever an emotion arise or a thought arise, she was able just to see it and let it drop right away. But that has effect of just letting go of stuff before you're actually able to see it and experience it. So it's kind of this ratio of what's our capacity to meet this experience and open to it and meet it with a quality of stability and spaciousness versus us being kind of shaken and shattered by that experience. And, you know, seeing where that ratio is. I mean, there's been many times in my life when I've been overwhelmed and shaken by that experience and learning how to find that sense of maybe taking a break, taking that sense of distance from it was helpful. And that allowed me then to come back to it, you know, as I was able to start to build that capacity to meeting it. See, the other aspect, yeah, I guess, if you want to speak more about that, Kelly, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're welcome to unmute and talk about it.
Yeah, I think you mostly addressed it. That's really helpful. I'm thinking of it now more as like, I think of distraction as a negative thing a lot of times, but it makes sense to me to think of a certain level of what you might call distraction, but that's going to allow more spaciousness can actually be helpful. So yeah, that's a helpful distinction. I think that pretty much addressed what I was asking. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. If you know what you're doing, if you know, recognize, okay, I just need a break, then it's really, there's no problem, right? If we're doing it just kind of out of habit or just without really conscious, then we might want to look at it a little bit more. All right. So if that's good for you, thank you for that comment question. All right. What else is out there in the Zoom world? Sounds like a good movie or something. Zoom world. Okay, Kirsten.
You know, my course is going to bark right when I come on. I was wanting to follow up with kind of something Katie said that I felt like I really connected with, which was, you know, not getting caught up in their story, but at the same time, being able to connect with them. And I was wondering if you have some thoughts or process of being able to connect when you're really struggling with someone else's story, not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's kind of interesting. It's in some ways, it's the same process that we use for ourselves. And so, you know, learning to first, you know, to really know our own relationship to emotion and how relationship to story, and especially that, that ability to kind of shift from the superficial to the deeper, to see what's the deeper belief, what's the deeper hurt underneath that. As you learn to do that for ourselves and very well, very deeply and very, you know, skillfully, you can start to see that when you're talking to someone else and just, you can hear the superficialness and, you know, just to, you know, I'll project on not knowing Katie's mom or dad, I can project on them. Sorry if it's, I'm just using that as an example, but let's say someone's talking about something that happened a long time ago and you can see there's the normal story, the normal superficialness that's going on, but maybe there's a deeper hurt. Like, you know, it sounds like there's that loneliness. There's that sense of loss. Maybe there's a sense of anger, and just offering a little bit, you know, first feeling it in your body and feeling that sense of just offering a few words along that way. And sometimes if you do it, if you really are accurate with that, it's like suddenly shifts everything in them. You know, I get to see this with students all the time, that there's this same process. You come in with a story that's kind of churning. And then through listening deeply, not just with the mind, in fact, much more importantly, with the body and with the heart, you can see, okay, there's that deeper emotion, that deeper feeling, that deeper belief. And just giving a little voice to that, or bringing a sense of highlighting that. Sometimes it's very indirect. It's very respectful that they discover that and connect with them in that way and themselves. And then suddenly you're connecting with that deeper emotion. And that's where things say, okay, oh yeah, I guess that has been a long time I've held that story. And like, oh yeah, someone's finally really listening. Because just how, you know, we have our own biases, everyone else has their biases. It's like, I may not be able to admit my vulnerability, but I can admit my anger, for example. And I can talk about my anger and you say, you can touch into that vulnerability. Suddenly I've been given permission to feel that vulnerability also, for example. So it's interesting how practice, internal practice, actually naturally can be external practice. It can naturally flow that way. But it's like we can't skip that step of really knowing our own hearts and minds. Otherwise, our own biases, our own, oh, I'm not going to feel that person. I'm okay with sadness. I'm okay with fear. But anger, no, I'm not going to feel that. You know, it's like we have to be willing to feel the whole array. Yeah, thanks for visiting us or joining us from California. It's so great that we can erase geographic lines here. All right. Anyone else have anything they'd like to share? Yeah, these are all great questions, and you know, they really help us to, you know, flesh out the talk, flesh out how it interacts. You know, even though it may seem obvious or may seem straightforward, when we actually start to articulate it, you know, through our own experience, that's a very deep, different way of learning, different way of engaging with the Dharma. All right, I'll give it a couple more moments to see if anyone.
I've got a question here.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead, David.
This is, I'm not sure, I'm kind of struggling with how to say this. It kind of did pass, so I guess I'm asking, I'll explain something that happened, and then maybe you could just say if there's anything, because it just sort of resolved itself and went away. But I wonder if there's a way to be more skillful with it, or to like speed it up, because it's just so unpleasant. Ultimately, you know, like that was just the thing. But there's just this, and it's happened to me before normally, like coming out of a retreat, but not normally just in normal life. But there was this spell where I just had a bunch of things happen where I just became like really aware of like endings, like everything was just like ending, and then it created a lot of extra fear and paranoia and stuff like that. And even though it was like really beautiful, like I was aware it's like beautiful day, it's really nice. And I'm kind of like gripped in this kind of hell realm of like fear and paranoia. And then like, it just seems like everything's sort of like ending, you know? Mm-hmm. And then it was just a matter of like, how do I manage like the spin that goes with that? Yes. And luckily I did. It kind of did stabilize and it worked through, you know, kind of came through that, but it felt like it went on for some time and it's mm-hmm. just really unsettling. It may well happen since this isn't the first time, maybe the third time. Maybe what do I do?
And when you say it went on for quite a while, like days or weeks or months? Days.
Yeah, maybe yeah. like a couple of weeks, maybe like 10 yeah. days probably.
Yeah. And yeah, particularly, you know, after a retreat, there's a way that can happen, but also can just happen in life too. So there's one style or technique of meditation, the Mahasi style, where you're just trained to focus just on the moment, you know, noting each moment, the breath, the body, and that's the whole practice. But as we do that, it's interesting that we often go through different phases that sometimes we might focus on the rising of the breath. And there's something shifts, then we start to notice the falling away of the breath, the cessations of the breath. And so that's just the technique starts to point to that. And at some point, you know, there can be that sense of paranoia or fear, or that sense of, okay, everything's just falling away. That becomes the highlight in your experience. And so for whatever reason, you know, that's came up after the retreats, coming up in life. That sense of things falling away, of things ending, and that sense of, okay, everything that I love is going to end, and that sense of fear around that. So yeah, you're absolutely right that the mind is kind of biased on that, focusing on that ending there. And so sometimes there is something to be learned there, something to really deepen in around that sense of disillusionment of things falling apart. And it really is that sense of realizing, okay, where is their true refuge? You know, where is the true refuge? You know, if the forms of life fall away, okay, I can't rely on them to be consistently here. You're really experiencing quality of dukkha in a very visceral, direct way. Okay, so if we, you know, just stay in that, it becomes really, you know, heavy and overwhelming. We start to see that, okay, what isn't changing? What is outside of change? Usually we focus on what's always arising and being born, but you're feeling that sense of really experiencing that sense of things falling away. But there's something that's actually holding both, something that's observing both. And that's really the point of practice, is to discover that, to see that things arise, things pass away, but there is something that is, to use the Buddha's word, the deathless, the unconditioned. And that's not something that's out there. It's not something in the future or in the past. It's something that's right here. And so you can, when those next time that time happens, review it as seeing dukkha very directly, seeing how the inherent unsubstantiality of experience is revealing itself. It's showing you in a way you can't avoid seeing. And say, okay, this is actually a gift. Okay, so this isn't where true happiness lies. It lies someplace else. And see if that can start to hold that question and see if it starts to reveal itself. Again, seeing it not in the form of life, but in something that's the formless.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, so you know, next time if that happens, you know, you feel free to reach out to myself or another teacher. It might be a nice way to work with it too.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so question from Michelle around letting go of the story in terms of how that relates to other cultures, which often use the story as a way of working with grief, of working with loss and around trauma, healing from trauma. So it's just a different way of working with it. So this talk wasn't looking at kind of that power of the story, but really looking at the limitations of story. So it's kind of a bigger question to unpack and talk about it. But you know, personally, I think the power of myth, the power of story, the power of ritual is very helpful with working with trauma, working with emotional difficulties. Yes. And then, yeah, the other question, second question is around that sometimes letting go of the story is helpful. And sometimes it seems like it invalidates our experience. So that's, I think that's an important clue to notice. Okay. There's that sense of fully embracing the story. And let me rephrase this. When I say releasing the story, it's releasing kind of the enmeshment and the lack of space around the story, that the story is the whole reality. So you release that, then the story still is there. Still the details of that experience, the difficulty of that experience is still there, but it's really joined by this quality of spaciousness, this quality of wisdom and compassion. And so that's really what transforms the story. So I think the way I talked about just negate the story, get rid of the story. The story is bad. I was actually talking more from the perspective of our belief in the thoughts as being the ultimate reality, to start to see that this is part of being human. I am, you know, I am a white male, for example. That's part of what I am in the world and how I need to skillfully navigate that world. But there's this other reality that I'm much more than that. And holding both of those allows the emptiness and the form to come together. This is really the stance between those two. So I hope that helps, Michelle.
Yeah, thanks. It kind of sounds like you're saying a bit of, it's not necessarily letting go of events as they happen, but letting go of... I guess it can maybe come down to the second dart, right? Letting go of all the swirls and things we create around those events.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. All the swirls, all the elaboration around that. And really the way that self, that creates a sense of self churning in an unconscious way. And really the sense of the actual events, the actual things that have happened, all the traumas, all the difficulties, all those pains, we actually able to meet that in a much deeper, fuller way. And we're able to hold the story more lightly. And it's kind of a paradox, but that's really the path. So maybe we'll talk more about that next week. Thank you, Michelle. All right. Thank you all for your engaged questions. I really appreciate that. And it helps everyone on the call to deepen into this topic.